Welcome to Talking History.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Angela, your work focuses on a very interesting institution, the Chinese emperor, and how that emperor negotiated his power and his image with the Chinese people. So I'm hoping today we can talk a little bit about how you developed an interest in something as strange to an American audience as the Chinese emperor of 200, 300 years ago. And what I would love to hear about is, first of all, who were these Chinese rulers that you look at, and what types of rituals are you interested in?
Well, the emperor that I wrote about in my book Of Body and Brush, Grand Sacrifice as Text Performance in 18th Century China, was the Qianlong Emperor, who ruled for 60 years in the 18th century. Now, he was a member of a group of people called the Manchus, and the Manchus conquered the Chinese heartland from the northwest. It's a place called Manchuria, so people may know it by that old name, left over really, was still being used during World War II. The Manchus were nomadic pastoralist people, so they were on horseback, and so they had some real differences between themselves and the Chinese. They were more closely related to the Mongols. And, of course, you remember that the Mongols had conquered China themselves under Genghis Khan long before. So when the Manchus started to eye the rich southern heartland of China, desiring to take it over, they modeled themselves after the Mongol Khan's empire. And they took Beijing in 1644. The Chinese dynasty was in a very, very bad way, falling from corruption and rebellions in China. And unbelievably, the Chinese emperor had invited the Manchus to come in and kind of clean up things, and so they did. Then he committed suicide and they stayed. So there they were in the heart of the Chinese agricultural land to the south. But they also had an empire that stretched much beyond China, and that included their own peoples, the Manchus, and numbers of Mongolians. So this empire is just huge. It actually, according to the Manchus, really included Tibet. But of course, we know that that's something that the Chinese and the Tibetans are still arguing about. And this argument about what, you know, whether or not Tibet is part of China really dates from the Manchu period. So the Manchu monarchy is a very complicated monarchy. It faces to the Manchu people, it faces to the Mongols, it faces to the Tibetans, and it faces to the Chinese. And the monarchy itself did a lot of rituals that would, rituals to integrate and to impress and to model the world for these various constituencies. I'm an historian of China itself. So I was interested in the face that the monarchy turned toward the Chinese. And that's the stuff that I really researched.
Okay. So if I'm understanding you correctly, then the Manchus used their rituals to interface with the various peoples in their empire. Mm-hmm. And so you're looking at how the emperor specifically interacted with his Chinese subjects. So the title of your book contains the phrase Grand Sacrifice. I'm assuming this is a ritual.
Yes, it is.
And what is this ritual, and what does it really mean for the Chinese people, and why are you looking at it?
Right. Well, can we step back a minute and talk about this, the category of ritual?
Sure.
In general for a second. This category of ritual is what we call in the business of doing history and anthropology a local category. This means that it's not a category that I have imported into the materials, but it's a Chinese way of thinking about ceremony, and the Chinese word for it is li, and that's spelled L-I. So this word li is usually translated as ritual, but li for the Chinese contains lots of practices and things that we wouldn't necessarily think of as a ritual, because we in the United States think of ritual as something that's very separate and very special, set apart from everyday life. But Chinese li is would be a better translation for it would be not only ritual, but also just etiquette, just politeness, so that it stretches all the way from the ways that you treat people in your everyday life, like, you know, the kinds of greetings you would give your parents in the morning, the way you treat your friends, how you host people at dinner, you know, all these kinds of things, all the way to something as specialized and as important and as difficult to stage as something like a grand sacrifice. So I ended up looking at grand sacrifice because it was a way to get to study this idea of li or ritual in China, but also to take into account monarchical power as well. So now the grand sacrifice is, there are actually four grand sacrifices done in China. And these four consist of a sacrifice to the altar of, at the altar of heaven, to the spirit of heaven. This is done at the winter solstice, when the year reaches its yin lowest point and tips over into yang energy. So, and the days start to get longer. So that's the sacrifice to heaven. The sacrifice to earth, the second grand sacrifice, is done at the summer solstice, at the opposite time, when the days begin to get shorter. Right. There's grand sacrifices also done to the imperial ancestors. So this is the sort of highest level of ancestral veneration. And we could talk about that a little more later, because it's through grand sacrifice and ancestral veneration that the monarchy models most closely rituals that are done in everybody else's house in China at a domestic level. And finally, there's another altar that's on a par with the sacrifice to the ancestors, and that's the sacrifice to land and grain. So in that sense, we have earth and heaven at the solstice times of the year, and then we have at the fall and spring equinoxes sacrifices to both the ancestors and to the land and grain. So it's in a sense those are sacrifices that are to spirits of, we might say, genealogical continuity. So the past, right, as people imagined it through people, their ancestors, and to continuity of identity as imagined through the land. So we have on the one hand the land, and on the other hand the ancestors. So this complex of grand sacrifices was the highest level of ritual or li stuff, you know, rounds that the emperor did. He did an enormous amount of other stuff, because there are two more levels of state sacrificial work, sort of a mid-level and then a lowest level. So there's grand, middling, and lower sacrifices.
Okay. Now, I think you made a good point earlier that we in the United States don't really think of ritual and power as intertwined. And in the Chinese world, they really, really are.
Yes.
And so how are they intertwined? You just talked about a few of these grand sacrifices, but how does that actually translate into power and the relationship to ruling?
Wow. How does a ritual actually, in a sense, produce power? Well, when you think about it, one of the most obvious ways, this is just the most obvious way, if I am in charge of a ritual and you come and you are going to perform the ritual that I am in charge of, I actually get to kind of be in charge of your body for an hour, say. I have a script here, we have a performance we're going to do, and you're going to do everything that I'm telling you to do. Now, that's sort of like a very simple way to think of it. And it's a little too much like a conspiracy, like, I'm in charge, I'm going to force you to do this ritual. Most people, even in our American-style ceremonial ritual life, which consists of what? Ceremonies in churches, but also, ceremonies, say, on the 4th of July, where we all get together and we watch a parade and so forth. So we actually have a ceremonial life that's quite, you know, quite complicated in the United States. We just don't notice it in this way. No. And so the easiest, I mean, like, but the thing about wonderful about ritual is that it's very rare that someone is actually ever in charge of these kinds of ceremonies. So that, in fact, say, for instance, I was raised as a Roman Catholic from the time I was a child. So I will take Roman Catholic Sunday morning Mass as an example of a ritual. Now, we might think that the priest is in charge, but in fact, he's not even in charge either. He's just the chief celebrant of this ritual that we all join in together. And so what it really is, curiously, is some ritual like the Catholic Mass, nobody's really in charge. We're all there together doing it, and interestingly, we all manage to get there on time, to do it at the same time, to do it together. We're all working through the same script. One of us is the celebrant, and he's sort of nominally in charge of this event, but the power of the Catholic Mass is that that we all come together and do it voluntarily. The power of a 4th of July parade is, in a sense, similar, that we all come together, do it voluntarily, and we look at ourselves doing these rituals, and we see ourselves displayed as a community doing something together makes sense to us all.
Okay, so it's a nexus of sorts.
It's a nexus of sorts, and its power lies really in the fact that it's not obvious. That the best rituals are the ones that people do because they think they really enjoy doing them. They do them, as it were, naturally. These rituals make sense. They're very meaningful, or they make perfect sense in terms of just, you know, everyday life. So the meaningfulness of, say, the 4th of July is the whole thing of parades, and, you know, there's a long tradition, say, in a small town of having this parade. There's not only a parade on the 4th of July, there are parades on other days as well. So when people get together and watch the 4th of July parade, they're also thinking perhaps of the St. Patrick's Day parade, or, you know, the homecoming parade, something like that. So there's that issue. Also, 4th of July, of course, is about, you know, the birthday of the United States. And so, you know, there are other kinds of ritual activities that go along with the big the sort of town level ritual of a parade, and that is that maybe people go home and they get together with a bunch of other families and they have a big picnic, or they go home and they go out in their backyard and they have a barbecue, and all over town people are doing these things voluntarily. They're doing them separately. They're doing them with their very own friends. But I'll be darned if they're not all eating pretty much the same foods, you know. So they're not even realizing that they're creating their community solidarity and declaring themselves the same as everybody else in their town, and, you know, and sort of while eating hot dogs, hamburgers, and various things like this. And if people serve something different on occasions such as this, like the 4th of July or Thanksgiving in the United States, it's remarked. You know, so maybe new immigrant families come to town, and they're Vietnamese, and when they go off at the picnic, they bring along spring rolls. So everybody at the picnic says, isn't that interesting? They've brought spring rolls for the parade. And then there's a lot of discussion of this, for the picnic, right? So I've been at events where this kind of thing has happened. So then there's a lot of discussion about your food, my food, our food, and so on. You know, oftentimes in the American case, where everybody congratulating each other on the fact that we can all have our own kind of food, and that's one of our ways of being American, right? So, and of course, this is really also a kind of ritual mechanism for enfolding the Vietnamese into being American, because, of course, they produce their food at this picnic and so on. So this is like a homey example of the power of ritual, even for us.
Is this how you got interested in ritual to begin with, by attending 4th of July?
No, not exactly. I actually got interested in the Chinese case, because I was taking a course in graduate school, and we were sent off into a particular kind of old-style document. This is called the local gazetteer.
Well, first of all, let me interrupt. Why don't you let us know a little bit about graduate school? Were you in history? I mean, you have a very interdisciplinary approach to your studies.
I do. You're right. Well, I was at the University of Chicago, and I was in the Department of Far Eastern Languages and Civilizations. This is known as Area Studies. And Area Studies departments were really founded after World War II in order to allow people to learn very, very difficult languages. So that there are, you know, area studies about India, there are area studies departments that do the Far East. I don't know if there are any that do Latin America. Nah, that's not such a difficult language, Spanish. Let's see. I think really pretty much it's South Asia and East Asia that have been area studies departments. Middle Eastern, I think, so to learn Arabic. But I soon, and I was very in, so that's the department I was in. It was Far Eastern Languages and Civilizations, working on Chinese, classical Chinese, modern Chinese, reading literature, and also reading history. Once I became interested, though, in this local category of Li, how I became interested in Li was that it was everywhere. Every time I looked into one of these local gazetteers, these Journal of Town Events, elites all over China would publish these things, maybe annually, maybe every couple of years, and they would write down all the important events that happened in their community. What I was very struck by was so many of the events that they discussed and the categories they put them in all revolved around kinds of Li, or what we would think of as rituals. But here it was, half the gazetteer is full of something called, it would be as though the history of an American town were nothing but a discussion of its parades, picnics, you know, mayoral inaugurations. I mean, you know, it's so interesting that they just spent so much time on this. And I went to my professor and I said, well, what's all this about? And of course, in these gazetteers, there's also rituals that actually include the gods, you know, invisible beings. And they're right there with all the other rituals. And he said, oh, yes, that stuff. He said, that stuff's very strange, he said, and it's very, very difficult to study. In fact, he said, it's so technical and so boring. He said, you really don't want to go off and study that. It was very funny, actually. And I said, oh, but I do, I thought to myself. So, but it was clear that there weren't a lot of resources sort of among historians and so on to really study this. So I went off to anthropology. Because I thought to myself, ritual, anthropologists know about ritual. And I thought, another culture, anthropologists know about another culture. And so I went off and basically then started taking courses in the anthropology department and did the entire, enough courses. I mean, I just did all my training, all my theoretical training was done in anthropology then.
But then you run into a problem, right? Because you are looking at Chinese emperors and Chinese society 200-300 years ago.
That's right.
And anthropologists usually do field work.
That's right.
Which means they're going and living among the people.
That's right.
Without turning yourself into an ancestor, how do you do field work in this context?
That's a very, very good point. The field work mode of producing anthropological writing is a very old one. And it's a kind of style of scholarship that really emphasizes, you know, the personal experience of being among people and talking to them, you know, as living people. But recently in anthropology, there has been a movement to understand anthropological writing also as being about writing. So once you have your experience of being an ethnographer among living people, you still have to come home, in fact, and write it down so that anthropologists, in the end, also produce a story. They produce a text. In fact, some people have noticed that what anthropologists write and produce, this being a narrative or a text, a story about the field work they've done, is actually, and this is a terrible secret, it's actually not that much different from what historians go out and produce after they've been in the archive or doing their reading. This was very disturbing to a lot of anthropologists who really didn't want to be, as it were, reduced to historians. Historians, however, found it extremely interesting because it made them feel sort of, I don't know, maybe sexier and more interesting to themselves and their students, because they could think, I have the joke that I think that history is the ethnography of dead people. So anthropology offers a lot of very interesting approaches to thinking about social life to historians, quite seriously speaking now, aside from this issue of both groups producing a text that other people read as their outcome of their research. Anthropology provides a lot of a lot more, especially if you are involved as the historian of another society, you know. So in a sense, I was doubly removed from my materials, not only were they in the past, and I never could remember who it was that said the past is a foreign country, but some famous historian said this, and I think that that's true. So there I was looking literally at another society and looking at that society's past. So I really felt that I needed some help from people who had very systematically thought about difference and distance. Anthropologists are very self-conscious about the fact that, as anthropologists, they are involved in looking at things and at people that are not usually from their own society. That has at least been the foundation of anthropology.
Okay. So you took the tools of the anthropologist and the historian, and you went back to study ritual and power in the emperor in the Chinese context, in the Manchu context. Then you're still stuck with a problem. You still have to present your material to your readers. And if you are looking at performance and ritual as performance, as you do, how then do you convey to your readers performance in a textual way?
Another really good question. Complicated question, though. Just now, when I spoke about the kinds of writing that anthropologists and historians both produce, I mentioned that both of them are texts. A text, once something is written down, it becomes a text. It becomes something that historians call a representation. Once you represent something, you've taken one thing and, in a sense, made two things out of it. You have the thing, and then you have its representation. And you then have a distance between the original thing and the representation that you have in your hands. Usually the thing that you've represented is gone. It may have always been gone, you know. But even if you're reading in the archive and you write down your notes in the archive and you come home and you write down your text, you've got three layers, because you've got those original people who left their records in the archive. You've got your experience of reading the records in the archive, and then you come home and you write your text down. So you've got the original people, you've got their representation of themselves, and then you've got your representation of their representation. We're getting very, very far away from anybody's body, aren't we? You know? So this is a genuine problem that, in fact, all historians really come up with. There's a very good sociologist named Paul Connerton who talks about how it is that people remember things. And historians are very interested in how people remember things. We're in the memory business, you might say. Paul Connerton said that all societies remember in basically two ways. They write things down. They store their information in places outside of themselves as human beings, as bodies. They write, or they build things, or they make paintings, or they make photographs, and they surround themselves with all of the with records of their experiences. And this information is stored outside of the body. But the other way that people and that societies store information is actually in the human body itself. This is a lot more, so this gets to your question about performance, right? How is it that we can ever have access to how people really lived in the past? It's something that all historians want to do. All historians want to speak to the dead. It's a longing that they have. They want to speak. People want to speak to their own dead. And historians really want to make the dead speak, and they want to talk to them. This is a difficult, difficult thing, of course, to do, and kind of a utopian wish. But I think it's really there. So when we think about these two modes of the storing of information that societies do and how they remember, one is through inscriptions, through writing records, and the other is through the body. How is it that people incorporate over lifetimes the memories of the things they have done? One of the ways they do it is through ritual. People are trained in every society to sit in certain ways, to walk in certain ways, to talk to others according to certain conventions, to do everything in our everyday life. in very specific ways. And if you've ever spent a moment in another society or another culture, even in England, you know that it's really different. There are different bodily habits. These bodily habits are passed down through time, from parents to their children, from teachers to students, and so on. Every society's sort of more obvious public ritual events, we might think of them as times when people get together and display to each other their incorporated knowledge. So they all get together and they rise and they sit and they stand and they kneel and they sing and they walk around and they do things in ways that take up these everyday lifetime incorporated ways of being in the body, and they make a kind of pageant out of them so that they can look at them together and reinforce them, so that they can then be further passed down through time. Historians have access to this stuff by looking at ritual handbooks, by looking at the architectural settings and the discussions of architectural settings, the places where bodies move, the handbooks that tell us how bodies are supposed to move, how people are to deploy themselves to each other and be together in their spaces, how they look and see each other. Even paintings will tell us something about this. If you look at a painting from another time or place and you understand it, in fact, as the record of a body's incorporation of gestures and of ways of being and of decorating itself and so on, you can read different things out of that painting.
Okay. Now, you are getting ready to go off on some field work again, to speaking to the dead, if you will.
Yes.
And this time you're going to a different part of China. You're going to be studying a different sector of society. And are you going to be looking at all of these things you just mentioned, the architecture, the paintings, the handbooks?
Yes. In fact, I am, because this project that I'm working on now, I think of as a companion volume to my first book on the 18th century monarchical ritual complex of grand sacrifice. This project is really going to be set in literati culture, or among the gentry. Now, it's very difficult to get anything about the Chinese peasantry, because they really didn't write. Literacy was a very confined practice, but we can certainly get out of the court and at least into the strata of the gentry. So I'm going to this place called Huizhou, which is in Anhui province in south central China, which is a very famous place. It's a small county that's in a beautiful set of mountains. But it's because it was a mountainous place, it was very isolated. Because it had very little land that people could farm, the people that lived there had to earn their livings in another way. They became merchants. Because they became merchants, they traveled outside of Huizhou and they became very rich. This meant that they sent their money back to Huizhou and built beautiful houses, beautiful ancestral temples, paid people to write family genealogies, handbooks about all the rituals of daily life. It also means that because they were away from home, they wrote a lot of letters home about their family business. That, of course, is an historian's goldmine, to ever find correspondence that way. So it's a great place to try to it's an archive of things and of records that is almost as rich as, or at least approaches the riches of, the archive left to us by the monarchy, which of course is the biggest archive of all. So that's the project that I'm going to work on. I'm going to work on filial piety in this setting, and on family relationships, and on domestic ritual, and so on.
Okay, now you've mentioned ancestors a number of times.
I have.
And they play a very special role in Chinese society and very connected to ritual.
Yes.
But probably most people in the United States really don't understand what the role they have is in Chinese society. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, I could talk about it all day, but I won't. Wow. You know, so now there's another local category in the Chinese sense that I have made so much my own that I just sit around talking about it without even explaining it to people, which is exactly how a local common sense category works, right? It's the stuff that you don't have to explain. So I guess I'm slowly becoming more Chinese, which also happens to historians as they start to become the things they study.
And anthropologists.
Indeed, and anthropologists, both, right? Both groups of people have the same problem. Ancestors, ancestral veneration right? Rituals that literally speak to the dead are very, very old practice in China. And they began, we know, from archaeological records, they were already around in around the year 3000 BC. In this very early founding moment of China, only the king himself had the right to worship his ancestors, to speak to his dead ancestors and ask them to intercede and send blessings down upon himself and his people, to intercede with other spirits in the invisible world. So in that early, early time, one's own ancestors were thought to be the best conduit, or they were thought to be your advocates, right, in the invisible world, almost your sort of emissaries that you had sent there. Who would speak on your behalf and send luck, blessings, rain, you know, and so on, down upon the earth. So we start with this very early dynasty called the Shang. Only the king gets to do this. Later on, by about the year 900 BC, we see that the king and his nobility get to speak to their ancestors. So now the nobility have acquired an ear up there in the invisible world near heaven. This is a great privilege. It's power. It's an access to a kind of power to be able to speak to your ancestors. And in a sense, the ability to perform these rituals, talk to one's ancestors, slowly, slowly, slowly spreads throughout Chinese society. So from around, say, the time of the Roman Empire, all the way to the equivalent in Europe of the Middle Ages, around the year 1200, by around the year 1200, every male, every Chinese male is thought to have ancestors that he can talk to and to have the privilege, and not only the privilege, but the power to speak to the dead in this way. So this is a very interesting thing. I think of this in a kind of world context as the Chinese, this is the Chinese idea of the widening access to the sacred, which is something that we also see happening in Europe. In the context of Christianity growing and in Islam growing, in Buddhism, you know, so, which of course we ourselves stand at the end of that. I even think to myself, how could you ever have something like either socialism or democracy if you didn't have the slow spread of the privilege and the power of access to the whole world, including the invisible parts of the world of the spirits, the world of one's ancestors, if everybody couldn't really do that. Now, the problem in China, as it was in most other places, is that this was a male privilege, and that it has taken only until a very recent time, the past few hundred years, that women have begun to fully exercise the same privilege of access to the dead and access to the spirit world. And I think that's kind of world phenomenon. So that's one of the importance of the ancestors is that.
And do ancestors still have this role in Chinese society?
Yes, people are exceedingly, exceedingly devoted to ancestral veneration practices. When somebody dies, you bury them, of course, you bury them away from the home in a graveyard, but you have in your home a small tablet that nowadays contains their photograph. You put this on the family altar, and you sacrifice by placing foods, usually people's favorite foods, if they've only been dead for one or two generations and somebody remembers what their favorite foods were. You put these foods out and you burn incense to their spirits on the family altar on the 1st and the 15th of every month, on their birthday and on the anniversary of their death day. And so they are kept there. You announce to your ancestors, all this group of photographs sitting on this altar, the important events of the family. Somebody has graduated from college. Someone is going to get married. You introduce daughters-in-law to the ancestors. And so this is something that has been, is still going on. Now, of course, China, as we know, has been divided in very interesting ways in the 20th century. In off the mainland, since 1949, and the with the winning of the Communist Revolution, Chinese ancestral veneration practices have been preserved most carefully and continuously in Taiwan, in Singapore, in Hong Kong, and in other places where Chinese emigrants have moved. On the mainland, under Maoism, under communism, there was a push to to abandon ancestral veneration practices as superstition, as not particularly useful for modernization. In the 80s and in the 90s, after the death of Mao Zedong, ancestral veneration practices have begun to be revived on the mainland as well.
So that means then that this ritual that you have examined in your book of grand sacrifice and ancestral veneration has a present-day manifestation.
Yes, it does.
And does this manifestation then still speak of power relationships and hierarchies and that sort of thing?
Well, I would say that it does. I would say most definitely that it does. At the local level, I mean, so with, even within the family, let us say, how, what kinds of power relations and hierarchies are displayed in ancestral veneration practices within the family? Well, the domestic ancestral altar is usually cared for, say, on the 1st, 15th, even the daily burning of incense, by wives. But the same women who care for the ancestors intimately and domestically at home don't have a particular role when the ancestors are venerated in the clan temple. That's a public space where the men go and get together, particularly in the south of China, and venerate the ancestors. The women stand in the back of the temple during these occasions. So that displays to people a differential of, we might say, status between men and women, but it also displays their, classically, right, their domains of power. Women having more power within the domestic setting of the household and the home, being more in charge of that. Men displaying their power together as a collectivity outside of the home. So on a very local level, that's one of the places where it is displayed.
And so when you go to Huizhou then in a few weeks, are you going to be looking for this type of thing? Do you have any idea of what you're going to
find? I am actually not sure how much of a revival of this has gone on as of now in Huizhou. I know that there's been a quite intense revival on the South China coast, in Fujian and in Guangzhou and in those areas. It remains to be seen, actually, what's actually going on the ground in Huizhou in terms of ancestral veneration.
And what about in terms of Qing Dynasty society? Do you have any idea what you're going to find? Are you going to be looking for male-female roles in ritual, that sort of thing?
Well, yes, I am. I am going to be examining. I'm interested in how filial, all the practices that surround the rituals of filial piety and in the ways that filial piety was passed down from generation to generation and sort of how children were inculcated with the idea of respect for parents and so on, how these practices actually help to create the distinctions that we find in Chinese society. One of the most important distinctions is the distinction between being masculine and being feminine, being a proper woman and a proper man. Another distinction that filial piety also inculcates or sort of produces in society is the distinction between we Huizhou people who have our loyalty to this Huizhou place where our ancestors are buried versus outsiders from Huizhou, other people whose ancestors are not buried here, you know. So this is a very interesting. Do you remember in the very beginning we talked about grand sacrifice and I said there are two grand sacrifices, one to the ancestors and one to the land and grain? Well, you can see how in a local community, the land that people live on is exactly the place where they deposit the bones of their dead. And so you see, your ancestors and your place are intimately connected. And I think that when you think in very modern terms about something like national identity, so on, this is an important aspect of Chinese identity. The fact that China is the place where, on a very local level, people bury their dead.
Everything you have said makes sense to me. You know, you are using the tools of anthropology to look at historical questions, you're looking at society, you're looking at culture, and only that way can we get a better understanding of what was really going on in China. And yet, your work has caused quite a stir among Chinese historians, you and a number of your cohort, I should say. Now, why do you think that is?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if I'm the best person to answer that question since it's about me actually, I've always been puzzled by, frankly, the stir that it has caused, because it all seems fairly obvious to me, as it should be obvious to you. I think that it is my devotion, and my real devotion to trying to understand the local categories of Chinese life in the 18th century, of trying to understand this idea of Li, of trying to understand the logic of people who think in yin and yang terms, right? The logic of a Chinese style of hierarchy that is very, very inclusive. In other words, where we have a hierarchy here, what we're really creating in our little family hierarchy is a whole family, each of whose members is important to the working of that family, but each of whose members has a different position in the family and is valued differently, but all of whom are necessary. So in other words, an inegalitarian society, but an inegalitarian society where everybody has a place, so that the sneaking suspicion that there are certain pleasures and certain safeties in that kind of inegalitarian system. This is one of the implications of the work that I do that I think that modern historians of China find uncomfortable, because I actually try to show why these social formations in the 18th century lasted so long and worked so well, and really try to unearth and display their sophistication for readers. And the 18th century is not a beloved era among Chinese historians. It is an era, in fact, that has been blamed by the end of the 19th century for being the kind of great, one historian famously called it the graveyard of China's modernity or something like that. And I find this very interesting. I find that the view of the 18th century that we have in the 20th century is very much shaped by the Chinese need to cope with European modernity and colonialism. So looking back into their own past and kind of blaming these alien Manchu rulers for ruining what might have been a good Chinese thing, well, I don't know if that's altogether fair.
Well, you made an interesting observation to me earlier. You talked about how these rituals at the imperial level, the grand sacrifice, and the behavior of the emperor, you see in some ways reflected in current Chinese society. You talked about Mao and the Cultural Revolution, and I thought that was a really interesting comparison. Mm. And I don't think that many people would make that comparison.
Well, I certainly, as a former, Maoist myself, I don't particularly want to reduce Mao in any way to being another emperor, because I know that that is the kind of move that's used oftentimes nowadays to erase the very real contributions of Maoism to the Chinese people making for themselves materially and socially a much better life. On the other hand, I think it would be quite foolish to not recognize that Mao ruled, if he didn't reign, he certainly ruled, using many forms ceremonially and ritually that have profound resonance with older forms of ritual power.
Right.
No question about that. You see, when I lived in Beijing, which I did for 3 years at Beijing University, when I lived there, I arrived with my Maoist politics, but mostly with my ritual knowledge of the 18th century. That's the stuff I knew the best, right? I found, curiously, that I felt socially much more at home among Chinese people on the ground than most of my Maoist friends. who really hadn't a clue of how to actually behave with people when they were occupying the same physical space with them. This would be, very simply, because the topographical metaphors that Chinese people use right now, today, to situate their bodies in space and to situate themselves socially vis-a-vis other people are the same metaphors. They use upper and lower, they use inner and outer, this is a vocabulary that is just very, very basic. I was quite struck by this, needless to say. My eyes were bulging out. I was like, my gosh, isn't that interesting that, you know, publicly and in so many ways, you know, we have distanced ourselves so far from this monarchy, and in fact, we have dug a giant canyon between modern China and the old superstitious monarchy. And yet, again, to go back to Paul Connerton's point about how societies remember, in their bodily metaphors and in the topography of being a person among other people and being Chinese, they're just deploying so many of the same metaphorical ways of arranging themselves in space that resonate so deeply with the 18th century. I think of the 18th century in China as early modern. Well, the 18th century in Europe is just, that's just the French Revolution. Good heavens, we're still stuck in the French Revolution in many ways, so I'm working out those issues. So I don't think it's odd that this should be, in fact, cropping up.
I think we're out of time, and so I really want to thank you for joining us today, and I find your work fascinating. I look forward to seeing your new work.
Thank you very much. It was really a pleasure talking to you.